And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU-FM. And like I said before the break, we are interviewing Eve Engler today. Eve Engler, Canadian author, activist, journalist, author of numerous books, and also co-author of numerous books. We have Canada and Haiti waging war on the poor majority, Canada and Israel building apartheid. We have a book about rink rats and radicals. It's From Rink Rat to Radical. Is that right, Eve?
Yeah, Playing Left Wing from Rink Rat to Student Radical.
And that is a sort of an autobiography of how you became involved in activism.
Yes.
Interesting. We've never expressly discussed that book, but we have covered at least two of your books here on this program because Eve, if he travels Canada, tours Canada, he gave us a very interesting presentation in Hamilton in the summer about Canada and Israel, and you can find information about that on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website. So we're very grateful, Eve, that you could be with us today. So thanks for coming with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Oh, it's no problem. You continue to put out articles on Haiti. You continue to research and make Canadians aware of what we're not being told about. And you write columns for a number of online publications. I've seen you pop up in Counterpunch, Global Research, Haiti Action Network's website, and so forth. And this time I saw you on Al Jazeera. And your article was entitled, West Still Undermining Haiti. And it was about the situation following the earthquake, the AIDS situation, and that caught my interest. And I think you managed to sum up and discuss a number of the most pertinent issues. I guess one of the things that you've shown that is eluding our attention as consumers of media here in Canada is progress, or lack thereof, in the recovery effort or reconstruction in Haiti. I understand the number of homeless is rather high, higher than listeners might be aware of. Can you tell us about where Haitians stand right now in terms of rebuilding homes and so forth?
Yeah, well, I mean, the numbers vary a little bit, but basically still between 1.3 and 1.7 million people are still living in tent cities of some sort or even worse after earthquake, and that's a very large proportion of the people who were victimized by the earthquake, which is, I guess, almost just over 7 months ago now. And so you still have most people living in tent cities. There's been very little in terms of building of, you know, homes or either for long-term housing or even sort of more what you know, for a, should be considered a proper housing for someone for more medium term, that has basically hardly started at all.
Yes, I'm looking at the photo that was enclosed or attached to your article in Al Jazeera, and you can see a young Haitian in the proximity of one of these tent camps. It looks very much like temporary housing or arrangements, lots of corrugated steel and wood and tents. It looks kind of like a refugee camp. And this is something, as you said, that more than a million people are living in 6 months after an earthquake that shook up their life. So I understand this isn't being discussed much in our media. It seems that we just want to leave the impression that our aid is doing a great job. And I know that there have been donations, and there was a lot of publicity towards those donations. There was a big show about the international aid. There were billions of dollars promised. Canada promised tens or many millions of dollars. Do you know roughly how much of that aid is being delivered?
Well, that, I mean, that's the issue here, is that the big part of why there has not been serious moves away from this dire conditions of people living in tent cities is that all this money promised by the U.S., Canada, France, a number of other countries, basically hasn't materialized. Something in the range of, I think, over $5 billion was promised at an important conference in New York at the end of March, and most of almost all of that money has not materialized. At the 6 months, as of the 6 month anniversary of the coup, less than 10% of the money that was announced had been actually given to Haiti. In the case of Canada, the Canadian government claims to have given $150 million in the six weeks or so after the earthquake. And there's, you know, so a lot of questions about what, you know, what that money actually was, whether it was about paying Canadian troops, you know, all the sort of the militarization that took place. But leaving that aside, Canada announced $400 million in aid at the big reconstruction conference in New York at the end of March, and basically none of that has materialized. The minimum payment that Canada could make
stay on the Reconstruction Committee, which was, I think, $30 million. Ottawa, at the last possible moment, made that payment. So basically, the Harper government is, you know, talks a good game, claims that they're, you know, they're actually making a claim that they've put more than $1 billion in aid into Haiti over the past, you know, 5 years. And you know, this $400 million post-reconstruction is part of that. But in reality, that hasn't really materialized. And then there's a whole other side to this component of when the money does materialize, what does that mean? So Canadian government has announced tens of millions of dollars since the earthquake, and you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars before the earthquake as well, but since the earthquake to reconstruct, to rebuild Haitian prisons, and to train the Haitian police and to sort of build up the repressive aspect of the Haitian state. There's very little in terms of money going to the you know, school systems, any public housing and on that kind of stuff. But the Canadian government's prepared. The money that they're willing to put into Haiti tends to go towards building up the security apparatus, which, you know, over the past 5 years is at least $100 million in Canadian aid has gone to supporting the Haitian police and the security system there.
Yeah, it seems our government loves spending money when it's going to jails or prisons or police in Canada or especially abroad. In the case of Haiti, that's been, I guess, a trend, you could say, in our government's approach to Haiti. And it's also the case, as you've been exploring in your article, that if that aid isn't going to prisons or police, then it's certainly not going to the Haitian government itself, the elected government or any representatives. I understand it's largely targeted at NGOs or piecemeal aid organizations. And it seems that there's a big effort, in fact, to keep the money out of the hands of the Haitian government. There's something like an emergency law, I believe you referred to, some kind of, it's like an 18-month-long state of emergency that the government gave up control over the reconstruction. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, basically the Haitian Senate was pressured very strongly by the international players. In the case of Haiti, the real international players are obviously Washington, Canada, France, and maybe Brazil. And they were pressured to pass this law, which basically made the country de facto a colony of the international community. So there's a interim reconstruction commission that's been established that actually has control over the aid money that's being put in to reconstruct after the earthquake, and that committee is co-chaired by Bill Clinton as well as the Haitian Prime Minister, and it's half of the committee is made up of foreigners. So basically, they get to decide how the money is spent. So the idea that this aid that Canada is giving, even the aid that's going, you know, to the Reconstruction Committee, which Canadian government's been very slow in dispensing of, that money will ultimately go to a body in which the Haitian government has only very limited say over, and that it's the money is actually held by the World Bank. And it's dominated by, or it's half of the positions are by foreigners, and this is just the continuation. I think this has to be seen in just a continuation of this policy of so-called international community, meaning the U.S., Washington, and France mostly, in terms of just usurping Haitian sovereignty and saying we know what's best. And you know, as the listeners probably know, you know, when the earthquake happened, there was a foreign occupation, UN troops, something in the range of 10,000 UN troops and police in the country. And the country was already under de facto occupation, which began with the February 29th, 2004 overthrow of Haiti's elected government by U.S. Marines with the support of Canadian and French troops. And so what we're seeing here is that the actual form with the 18-month emergency law that the Haitian Senate passed, that giving the power to the Interim Reconstruction Committee, is you're seeing the actual formalization of foreign control over Haiti. And that's something that's been widely condemned within Haiti, and the parallel that is made repeatedly in the Haitian media is that this is the same thing as what happened in 1915 when the U.S. troops landed and they were able to obviously get Haitian politicians to sign over authority to the U.S. occupation. That the U.S. occupation lasted for 19 years and obviously led to a serious curtailment of Haitian sovereignty. Had a really terrible impact on Haiti's subsequent development.
Yes, it sounds like Haiti's becoming a sort of trusteeship in the current situation. And I know Canada talked a big game about the aid and the money that we were going to give. And while there's been difficulty delivering that, even when it does get there, it can be difficult putting it in Haitian hands. And you use the term Republic of NGOs to describe what's happening there. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, Haiti is the place in the world where NGOs are the most powerful than anywhere else in the world. Before the earthquake, there was estimates of as many as 10,000 so-called non-governmental organizations. Many of those are international. Many of them are also local, but usually the local NGOs are tied into international, or work with or dependent upon, financially speaking, international NGOs. And those international NGOs are usually dependent upon Western governments for their funding. In the case of Canada, Canadian NGOs dependent upon the Canadian International Development Agency. And that's usually when we refer to NGOs, we're actually referring to government-funded organizations. We're not referring to groups like the Canada-Haiti Action Network, which is an NGO, it's a non-governmental organization, but it's not usually, it's thought of more as a political organization or a social group or whatever. But so when we're referring to NGOs, we're usually referring to government-funded organizations. And Haiti is basically over 80, this goes back prior to the earthquake again, over 80% of social services in Haiti were run by NGOs. In the case of schools, over 80% of schools are run by NGOs, much of the health system. And so basically you have very little in terms of a Haitian governmental capacity, especially with regards to the social services that most Canadians consider to be important, whether that be picking up the garbage or health or schooling or public sanitation, etc. And so the Haitian government does very little on that front, and it's the NGOs that run that. And that's been a very conscious plan of the Canadian-U.S. Governments over the past couple decades in terms of undermining the Haitian government. And one of the ways they've done that is by funding what aid money goes into the country is channeled through non-governmental organizations and not given to the Haitian government. So you look at this recent, with the reconstruction, interim reconstruction committee, and the money that's been going in so far, number says less than 3% of the actual of the money that has actually been given post earthquake is actually given to the Haitian government. So most of the money that Canada and other countries are putting up is being channeled via non-governmental organizations. The Canadian government has announced tens and tens of millions of dollars to different Canadian groups like Oxfam Quebec or Development of Peace and others. And so what you're having is this, again, the continuation of the weakening of Haitian governmental capacity to provide the services that most Canadians want and I think that most Haitians want. And so I think that it's a pretty disturbing trend. And in the case of Haiti, you really see the power of NGOs and actually, quite frankly, the very disturbing role that they've played in undermining Haitian capacity.
Well, as one commentator put it, it's good to donate money to a charity or an organization to build a school or a water pump, but you wouldn't want your whole country run that way or in that fashion. We're speaking with Yves Engler, co-author of Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, author of a number of books. We're just discussing the recovery efforts in Haiti, and I also wanted to turn our attention to the elections as well. You had mentioned, Yves, that there had been media commentary, there had been some feelings in Haiti that the current presence of internationals in Haiti resembles the occupation that happened in 1915 in some ways. You know, that gets me wondering what's happening in the Haitian media. What are people talking about in terms of current events and politics with the election going on? Because I understand this is somewhat of a debacle once again. I've got information that only a fraction of the money being used to run the elections actually comes from the Haitian government. So the rest comes from foreigners. I think there was $30 million or so being allocated for the elections, and I think $7 million comes from the government. Do you think that could have an impact at all on the current electoral process?
Yeah, I mean, this is since the coup in 2004, it's really been U.S., Canada, and France that have funded the different elections. And that has to be contrasted to the previous election, which were actually much more democratic, much more open to participation, that was mostly funded by the Haitian government. And there's, you know, a lot of manipulation that's going on with regards to elections. And the recent phase, the most important thing is going on with Haitian election is the fact that the most popular political party in the country, Famille Lavalas, and when I say most popular, I'm talking about most popular by a factor of 10, 10 times as popular as the next most popular party in the country, they have been excluded from participating, and that they have been excluded from participating since Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the head of Famille Lavalas and then president of Haiti, was forcibly removed from the country. So the elections taking place at the end of November are of highly, highly questionable legitimacy. And the one of the things that's gotten most of the attention with regards to the Haitian election is the question of Wyclef Jean, a well-known Haitian-American singer. He attempted to be a candidate in the election, which was rejected, which his candidacy very clearly contravened electoral law in terms of having to live in the country for I think it's 5 or 7 previous years, and Wyclef Jean has basically lived in the U.S. Since he was 9, 30 plus years ago. So his candidacy was rejected. That received most of the attention. And I think that if you were to look at what Wyclef Jean's candidacy in the election, from the most conspiratorial standpoint, which in the case of Haiti, unfortunately, I think we do have to at least look at things from that perspective to some extent. And basically, Wyclef Jean's candidacy was an attempt to divert the attention from the fact that Famille Lavalas is being barred from participating, and the fact that in the post-reconstruction or the post-earthquake phase of situation now, the international powers understood that the elections was, you know, the candidacies and head elections was going to receive more attention than in the previous elections where Famille Lavalas was barred, but they were able to pretend like they were somewhat democratic because the Canadian U.S. media more or less didn't pay attention to the situation. And that people like Bill Clinton and others within U.S. circles basically asked Wyclef Jean to put his candidacy in for the election as a way to divert attention from the real disenfranchisement, the real issue, which is the fact that Famille Lavalas is not being allowed to participate in elections. So I think that Wyclef Jean's thing, in large part, was a sort of media diversionary tactic to allow the Electoral Council to just, once again, exclude Famille Lavalas from participating in the elections.
So I understand, yeah, he's not able to participate in the election, not being a resident of the country and so forth. There have been similar impacts on the Famille Lavalas party in terms of the way that the laws have been restructured. As you said, Lavalas has been barred, and a large component of the reason why Lavalas can't run is because the party leader, Aristide, is unable to sign certain documents since he's currently living in exile, I suppose you could say. So how does that work exactly?
Yeah, no, there's not even, quite honestly, most recent previous attempts to bar Famille Lavalas. So, for instance, in the 2006 elections, Père Jean-Just, the priest, Father Jean-Just, was barred from being the presidential candidate for Fermi Lavalas, and that was on the grounds that he couldn't come in personally and sign the proper electoral documents to put in his candidacy. And the reason why he couldn't sign that was because he was sitting in jail as a Amnesty International defined prisoner of conscience. But even that was dubious because the actual Haitian electoral laws allow a second party to be able to sign on behalf of someone, and Jean-Just obviously had that second party, and the Electoral Council still blocked it. And the same thing goes today. Basically, Aristide put in, he signed the doc from exile in South Africa, and that's obviously imposed exile. And he signed the documents, and they still came up with something. What they did in the 2006 election, the Electoral Council, what they're doing today is they sort of imply that there's two different Fermi Lavalas. There's these different factions of Fermi Lavalas, and because different factions of Fermi Lavalas have put in their candidacies, therefore we can't accept any of them because it's all, we can't decide who's... But this is all just smoke and mirrors. It's very clear who the head of Fermi Lavalas is. You probably can ask all of the 8 million Haitians who the head of Fermi Lavalas is, and every single one of them will know that it's obviously Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This bears barely a pretense of legalese. It's just simply we don't want their participation because they will win.
Well, once again, it looks like elections in Haiti are severely compromised, unfortunately, and we've covered similar stories in the past, but at least there is some good news. I understand you're going to be coming to McMaster here in Hamilton in September. Is it the 30th that you're coming?
Yeah, it appears that we're speaking on Canada's role in Afghanistan on the 30th, and there might be even an event the previous night or following night about a Canada-Israel event, but the details are to be confirmed, but it appears that, yes, September 30th in at McMaster.
Well, this is interesting. For those of you who might have missed the event in the summer, you might have a second chance, of course, because Eve's new book, Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid, has been sweeping across the country, and I've seen it advertised in numerous venues, being discussed and reviewed, and you can be a part of that too. Well, Izzo, we've got to keep some notes on that when you're coming and see if we can give people more specific details when we have more information. That's the end of September when Izzo will likely be in Hamilton, so we want to keep our eye open for that and keep that space available on your calendar. So, Eve, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me, Ben.